welcome to CardiCast, a glam podcast brought to you by New Cardigan. Our December Cardi Party featured RMIT PhD candidate and artist Stephanie Milsom discussing her recent exhibition, All of It, a collection of every piece of information Google has collected about her. Stephanie discusses data as art, digital privacy, and just what is her relationship with her own data. Tonight, as you probably all know, we have Stephanie Milsom, PhD candidate here at RMIT. Stephanie is a self-obsessed artist and academic based here in Melbourne, Australia. She is forever chasing lost time, and she's here tonight to talk to us about data mining and art. Take it away, Stephanie.
Hi, I'm going to read off paper because it's Friday. It's hard. Chris, thank you so much for having me today. I'm going to be talking about an exhibition that I had at First Sight Gallery earlier this year, which was basically all of the information that Google had collected about me in a series of bound books. So I'm going to talk a bit about the process of making that work with attention to what it felt like to data mine myself, how that feels, and also what it looks like. Then I'm going to talk a bit about the finished work itself and some common responses to that before kind of touching on this fragmented and disconnected relationship that I have with my data, and I think that all of us have with our data. So through making this work, I really wanted to consider what my relationship with my data was and question whether it was intimate enough to form an autobiographical or a confessional diarist practice. So to fill you in on me a bit first, I'm a Melbourne-based artist and academic. I teach intermedia and cinema studies here at RMIT, and I think that's something that's really important to note, is that the background that I come from that kind of informs everything I do isn't like computer science, it's like cinema studies and like art history. It's a very kind of different perspective on data, I think. And I use that to sort of frame the lens that I look through this stuff, particularly in how it relates to autobiography and also autobiography's relationship to archives. So I think I'll start by talking about the data that I'm using and that I used in this work. I say data a lot, and I'm sure we all have very different ideas of what data might be. So the data that I used for this exhibition came from two kind of places, what I call aggregator gathered data and self-gathered data. So I'm sure we've all heard like big data, this sort of booming, ominous kind of commercial term. And that's sort of where most of the industry in data is, and it's where most of the money comes from as well, mainly because of targeted advertising and the value that people give data. So what makes up aggregator gathered data, and indeed what makes it so valuable, is this idea that it's collected through what's called prosumption, which refers to the way which when we use the internet or social media or other devices, that we simultaneously consume and create content. So when we use Facebook, for example, we're browsing, we're looking at pictures, we're looking at stuff, but by doing that, we're also giving information to Facebook. We're showing them things that we like, what time we might be doing certain things, when we're most likely to look at food, clothes, and other information like our searches and browsing habits that they can use in exchange. So in exchange for free use of web services, we sort of routinely allow corporations to collect this data, either for themselves, but also to be sold on for advertising purposes. And that's how you get targeted advertising. So like if I Google gardening supplies a lot, I'm gonna see a lot more ads for gardening supplies. The other kind of data that I refer to in my work is what I call self-gathered data. So this is a practice that can be described sort of more broadly through the quantified self movement. Anyone heard of that? Yeah, one person. Basically, it's like all of the like Silicon Valley kind of tech dudes being like, oh, I can put a microchip in my arm and it can like record all of this stuff all the time and it can have all this information about me. That's really cool. Which are probably, I don't know, borderline. So basically, innovations in technology that allow tools and devices to monitor and record aspects of our lives for self-improvement. So you see it in things like the Steps app or in Fitbits.
and other wearable technologies where data is recorded kind of ambiently in the background to be analyzed and aggregated later. I think it's really important to note that it's not a new thing to record stuff about yourself to then use it for self-improvement, like we've all kept diaries, that sort of thing. But technology has made this practice a lot more accessible to the mainstream, and also made the information that it collects a little bit more scary. A conclusion that I had maybe like a few weeks ago, that actually like putting a distinction between these two kinds of data isn't a good thing, and it's sort of a bit of a funny binary that I've set up for myself. Mainly because the self-gathered data that's collected by Fitbits and Steps is also sold on for advertising purposes. And in a lot of cases for health science purposes, so Clue is a really big app, but it's also being used by the US government to form one of the biggest women's health studies of all time. So they use all of the data from that kind of back-endedly into this, so no one's quite sure about it. And in the same way, I can use my Google search history for self-improvement as well. So I think probably the best way to describe the data that I'm using is actually more in sort of the way it's collected, and this idea that it's collected by ambient media machines. So they're collecting information about me indifferently. I can just switch it on and it'll keep collecting and collecting and collecting. It doesn't really care what it collects. So I guess, yeah, that's probably the main thing to think about with the data that I'm talking about today. It hasn't really specifically been collected by anyone, but rather by machines that can process really large amounts of data that can then be examined by corporations, however. So what does it feel like to data mine yourself? It feels really bad. It feels so bad. I really wouldn't recommend doing it unless you want to feel like never using technology ever again. Burn the internet down, okay? So I was really, really shocked by how much information there was about me from Google alone. It was this very uncomfortable feeling. I think for many of us, we don't really think about what's being collected. It's sort of in the back of our mind, but it's not something that we think about. And seeing it all in neat folders, like secured away, being like, here's every email you've ever sent. Here's all of the time you've spent doing this, was really, really confronting. And I just wanted to like print it out and make it tangible, because what you get is like this data dump that's just clustered together. It all kind of looks like that, and it's just like big, but it's also really tricky to get through and work it out. So I just wanted to print it out. What happens when you download your data, in case anyone wants to, it's really easy through most websites. Basically, you just send a request through an online form. Google you don't even have to interact with a person. They just have a button that you press, and then a few days later, they email you a zip folder, and it's got like everything there. But the folder's also quite vague. So you've got things like your general profile settings, every file in your Google Doc, every email you've ever sent, including all of the text and all of the replies, every email you've ever received as well as every search, web page, calendar event, actions that you've done through the platform, websites you've clicked out onto. So mine came in at maybe 50,000 pages long. But again, it was really, really difficult to actually calculate that and quantify that. Because so many of the folders that I got just directed me to web pages, where it'd be like, oh, this web page is a list of how many times you've listened to this song on YouTube. And it like sort of looks contained and then spiraled out into lots of different places. I also ended up with all of my YouTube history because Google bought YouTube, and then all of that data got put in there as well, which was fun. So looking through all of the information that Google had collected about me, it kind of felt like looking through an old diary, except it was very expansive and almost felt like a little bit scientific. So there's a pretty clear charting of every medical ailment that I've had when I've had the internet, as well as my music taste, and not in like the kind that I want to see, but like rather what I was actually listening to and like what I was really interested in. So mainly Kali Ray Jepsen. So looking at my data was kind of like reading this embarrassing fact file about me, and I did read it all. It took me about 2-3 weeks to get through it all, but I got there. I think probably one of the strangest things I found was like reading through my search history. And I got this weird thing of like feeling like I was remembering every search that I made. So like this section here, that was an example of what kind of the clumps of data look like. But it was a video, but I don't think it's gonna play. Yeah. But yeah, imagine that, but like times 100, 150, just like churning through while it's trying to load all of the information. Okay, so this is a section of my search history where I had like a really clear memory of what I was doing when I did it. So you can see, can you see? Is it very small?
No,
okay, something was happening in the sky where I was like, red sky at night, eerie bright, what's going on? And I have this really vivid memory of like being in my bedroom in like a house in Yarraville that I lived in where the curtains didn't work very well, and so I had this red glow coming into my room all of the time, and having like this really like sleepless night being like, I just want to like work out what's going on, and then eventually giving up and listening to Courtney Barnett and falling asleep. And I think this section of the data almost reads like quite poetically, and I find there's a lot of this in the search history, and there is a lot of poetry kind of emerging in like computational nonfiction where this stuff's starting to come out. But perhaps only one that I might read into it because of the memory that I have associated with it. So without that memory, it becomes quite a malleable piece of text. And I think interpretability is something that I'll think about a bit more later on. This is my favorite section of my data. But it's also one that no one mentioned to me at all in the exhibition that I had. So a common thing throughout the exhibition was that people would come up and show me a section of my data that they really liked. And they were like, oh, yeah. And I always wanted someone to bring me this one. And they never did. Probably because it was in the middle of a big book. So the work itself was held at First Sight Gallery in October. This is kind of a rough view of like the install. I was quite torn about how to display the data at first. Initially I thought that because I primarily work as like a screen practitioner, I thought I was going to be making like videos with it and have them rolling through. But after seeing the data, all I really wanted to do was print it all out and put it in books. Because I think it's really tricky to sort through the data on screen. It puts it back in that kind of voidy screen space where nothing's quite tangible. And by putting the work onto paper, I was making what is an abstract concept quite tangible. And by printing it out, I felt like I was making it something that actually existed. I also did this to foster a connection between a written diary. And I wanted the audience of the work to physically interact with it and feel like they were literally rifling through a private diary-like object. So I wanted there to be this sense of uncomfortability when you're like peering through the pages. So the finished work was this series of books. There's one from each year from 2010 to 2017, and then a book of browser history, of YouTube search history, and YouTube browser history. And so here lies kind of one of the first tricks of the exhibition. The show was called All of It, and it just wasn't at all. I focused on my Google search history and my Google browser history, as I thought that these were more interesting artifacts to look at, and rather than going through all of my Google Doc and having all of that stuff there. And I think it painted a more eerie picture of what Google collected as well. So I didn't omit any searches or cross anything out, but I did take out things like my calendar, my email, and my Google Docs, because I just thought they were very visually unattractive. And in doing this, I sought to create a link between aggregation companies too. So someone engaging with this work literally had to trust me, and they did trust me, when I said that this was all of the data that I had. Just like I have to trust Google when they gave me this takeout, because I do not think this is all of the information that they have. I'm almost definitely sure that it isn't. The same thing happens with Facebook data. When you download your Facebook data, they're not legally allowed to give you anything that they've collected about you from someone else. So if they have your phone number because you're a contact in someone else's phone, they're not allowed to tell you that, because that validates that person's privacy, which is very interesting. So I think there's some stuff missing here. Another misleading component of the work is actually the idea that it's all my data. So if you look at some of these searches here, So these searches here, you've got things like VCE results from a year that I wasn't doing VCE, nursing courses and public health jobs, which I just do not, have never even come close to. I worked out that HIMAA is Health Information Management Association Australia, so my mum does. So basically what had happened is I'd gone to my parents' house and they don't have their own Google accounts. I'd logged on, hadn't logged out, and so Google had collected all of the information from my family computer for like a year, and put it under my name because it just thought that's where the information was coming from, even though it's coming from my parents and my sister mainly. But without knowing that, how are you to know and how are Google to know? And this raises a few really interesting questions about data surveillance programs and how easy it is for information, even entire personalities or interests, to be misattributed because of this. And this is really a growing concern, especially when you consider how our digital identities are becoming increasingly intertwined with and having effects on our real lives. So things like health insurance, police surveillance programs, they place a lot of trust in the data that they gather about other people. A very interesting flag there, I think. I think another really interesting part of this exhibition was how interpretable this information was. So when people spoke to me about the work, they spoke about seeing clear narratives emerge or being able to follow my train of thought really, really clearly. Not only was every narrative that was presented to me very, very different for the same piece of text, there's actually none in there. So because I'm not very good at coding, I hadn't been able to like sort through my data and put it in a clear chronological order. But people read that into the books. Whether that's to do with the form of reading a book or not, it was very interesting. I think it's something to think about as well, is that internet history isn't something that can be really read with a linear narrative or story. If you think about how you use the internet, you don't go like top down, you tab out. Mm-hmm. And I think data doesn't really account for that in a way, and that there's things going here, and so to try and put it into this little narrative is a really tricky thing to do. And this became this one of these key things that I thought about from this exhibition. The idea that sure, in data, patterns do occur, and it is very easy to draw patterns out of here. You can see clear interests. But there's also multiple ways to read vast quantities of data and multiple ways that it can be interpreted. Again, this raises some tricky implications with things like how the data is being used by health insurance, monitoring terror threats, that sort of thing. Because the data can also be used selectively by people and by companies to read what they want to see in the data and justify something. It also raises a kind of double-edged sword that you get when you work in autobiography. There are some genres, like memoir, where you're tending to question the author and play with this idea of whether you're presenting a factual or a fictional account. But when you're an artist or even a person that says, I'm going to confess now, or I'm writing in my diary, we have a tendency to believe them in what they're saying is true. And this has increased even more so with data. There's this implicit trust here, and one that I found was surprisingly not questioned throughout the show, because obviously this isn't all of my data. I made aesthetic choices of stuff to cut. But there's also no history of incognito browsers, and some of the searches aren't even mine. Now, this idea of trust and belief is sort of a very, very big idea, and one that's been written a lot more in regard to diaries, in particular war diaries. This idea of things coming from within the whirlwind of something, allowing them to be seen as more real. But I don't really have the time today to sort of open up the can of worms that is authenticity, or authentic selves. So I think maybe we can talk about that a bit in questions. For me, I think the authenticity of this work ultimately comes down to this idea of shame. So to confess something, you're typically confessing a sin or a crime, or a dark and personal secret to a friend. So something we confess is typically something that we keep to our private selves or we bury away in our diaries. So there's this question of why would we lie about something? And I think shame is this theme that runs through the work quite a lot, because people really engage with this work and would spend a lot of time poring through the pages of it. If you see these photos here, people are sort of head in book and like sitting down and reading, which is something that I was worried wasn't going to happen at all. I feel like if you put something in a pedestal on a gallery, people automatically are like, should I touch that? But people really jumped right into this and really dug deep. And whenever I spoke with people about why they were looking through the work so much, they all spoke about kind of this idea of looking for something bad, or something for me to be ashamed of. So lots of people that I spoke to were like, oh, I'm just looking for like porn. I'm looking for you looking for porn. And this idea of like looking for shame is a really interesting thing, because I think it happens a lot on the internet, and it's something that happens a lot, especially to women online. So where am I talking about? It also happens a lot in performance art. I think Tracy Emin is a really interesting person to think about here. Nat Squama, when she talks about the Zoom function on Instagram, she talks about this idea that the Zoom function on Instagram allows us to sort of seek out vulnerability in people's shots. You're like looking for something slightly out of place, something that you can be like, oh, this celebrity, like they're just like me, like they're human and they're real because they have something to be ashamed of, or something that they're vulnerable about. So I think as people looked for a source of shame or vulnerability in my work, what they're actually looking for is this kind of authenticity in it, or something that's discernibly me in the work. Which I don't think there is in there at all. So cultivating vulnerability is something that's been written about by Frank Peretti. He sort of opens up this idea in 2001, but actually the more you place it into like social media, the more it works. He has this idea that contemporary society places value on vulnerability and authenticity to the point where they're almost a currency and a way of ascribing value to something. So I think that's really interesting, especially if you think about the way that celebrities engage with Instagram, where the more you share, the better of a celebrity you are and the more likable you are. And functions like stories open that up a lot as well, where you can dive right into the moment in someone's life. It's also quite reflective in reality TV. I think a lot of this work is related to reality TV in a weird way. I think another good way to think about this is sort of through the artworks of someone like Tracy Emin. Her work is essentially that of a celebrity. It's a public persona that she builds around herself and makes us want to invest in her as both an artist and a person. And we want to read more and more horrible things about her and discover more in the work. So she's almost turned herself into a currency, which I think is what I'm almost doing in this work now. It's kind of developing like a new data persona that people can read out in like lots of different ways. Whether anyone found what they were looking for in my data, I'm not sure. I think people tried so hard to find something horrible because they were interested in whether their data could be so revealing as well. But because apart from like the locations here, really these searches could be anyone's. They're just multiple searches in a random order. And I think any interpretation of like personality or identity that comes out of this is kind of built around like lies. I think I had so many people talk to me about this work being like a brave work. Like, oh, it's such a brave thing to do. But I think it's just not, because it's like, we've all got this and it looks roughly the same for all of us. We all Google dogs, we all Google recipes. Like, there's a few things that might be slightly different, but kind of at the heart of it, there's nothing that you can be discernibly yourself from, apart from like locations and that information, which is where it starts to get a little bit more like, oh no, you know who I am. I think I'll kind of like wrap it up there. I think this exhibition made me realize like quite a few things. I think foremost that our relationship with our data is very, very, very complicated. It's something that can be seen as being revealing and intimate, but it's also something that's far more prosaic than that, and in that it's not revealing at all. There are some traces of intimate moments and intimate data in here, but because of the sheer quantity of it, it's almost too hard to find them. And I think that's where aggregation starts becoming key here. So it's both like in bulk that patterns do start to appear. So for me, probably a love of the bomb weather radar and MasterChef recaps are the most searched for things. But these patterns are also really easy to misread, and the raw data has no way of weeding out these mistakes. Because there's so much information, you can read so many different things into it and make so many different presumptions about who I am or who I could be. So I think, yeah, there's lots of room for a lot more research here and a lot more discussion about data and identity and all of this stuff that kind of goes on. I don't know, that'll do.
Short and sweet. Does anybody have any questions?
Are you having any plans to move on to Twitter later? You know, because there's a big one.
Yeah, I'm doing something different with Twitter at the moment. I'm making a bot out of all of my tweets. To make like a bot that talks like me, and I'm kind of putting this data into like auto-generate dialogue for myself, and then I'm using Voco, which is the speech generator, to generate speech with that to see if it's any different. I don't know, I'm really interested in, because I think Twitter's really interesting. It's something that people are using the data from in lots of interesting ways. There's lots of companies that like mine people's Twitter to find correlations between like people that tweet about like, or like, oh, I hate Telstra, and then like finding things that they can sell to people through that on like Telstra's like advertising site. And so that's this huge industry that's like opening up, like not like robots doing it, but like people doing it and being like, oh, these people tweet about this, but they also tweet about this. So these are like the cat, it's just advertising, like again, like new profiles of people to sell things to. Yeah, Twitter's very interesting.
When you were talking about Facebook, I was wondering whether or not you were pre-Instagram. So Facebook bought Instagram, didn't they?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So whether or not that you must have been just before that?
I haven't used my Facebook data for any work, mainly because I find the Facebook data really scary.
Oh.
Because the Facebook data has a lot of facial recognition data in it, so Facebook track your face and your mood when you're using Facebook a lot of the time. And you can see that in your data. And I don't know if I'm ready to stop using Facebook yet. So if you look at like Mark Zuckerberg, he always has like the tape over his camera. And it's because pretty much everything you're doing on the internet now, your camera is being like turned on in the background, and like the technology that like looks at like what your face looks like and what your mood might be when you're like buying something is like really really getting there at a very quick level. Yeah, I reckon it would have all of the Insta stuff in it as well. And this is what keeps happening to your data as well, is like one company owns it and then another company owns it. And then like with Vine recently, like the company that owned the data is like gone, but you can't get rid of it because people have like bought it. And it's like, yeah, it's a big, big capitalist mess.
That leads me to another question, which is, can you delete any of this data that you downloaded from Google at all, ever?
If you want anything that Facebook has collected about you to be gone, even if you die, it can only be deleted, and even then it can't really be deleted because they own it as well. If prior to your death you've signed a waiver being like, oh, I'd like my Facebook account to be deleted when I die, otherwise they're not allowed to touch it, you can ask them to like scrub your data, but because there's so much of it and it's owned by so many different people, a lot of the time you can't get rid of it at all. Because it's like if you are taking part in a study, so most of the stuff that you accept when you accept the terms and conditions is like you accept that the data will be kept up until like you say you don't want it to and they can't collect anything after that, but everything before that is like free game to use. It's very hard to make it disappear, and it's sort of ownership plays like a big part in that as well, because it's like, who owns this data? I had a lot of problems like going through like an ethics committee with this work, because there's this question of like, well, this is my data, but technically it's like a data source of Google's that I'm using, and like I need like a lot of permission from them to do that, even though what I'm looking at is like a collection of every action that I've taken, and like theoretically I could have done it myself, but I didn't. There's a lot of books coming out at the moment about like how the legal system really needs to keep up and like start doing some stuff about data, and I think be a very good idea, because especially when you have companies that exist across multiple continents, which law are they bound by? Facebook can like go through here where the laws aren't as tight as they are in the US. It's very interesting.
I have a question for you. So you said you've got a cinema and art history background.
Mm-hmm.
Where's your PhD sitting within RMIT? Like, which school is it sitting?
MediaCom.
And who's your supervisor? What's their background?
So I have two supervisors sort of on both sides.
Yeah.
So one of my supervisors, Adrian Miles, who is a sort of like internet materialist kind of theorist. And then my other supervisor is Adrian Danks, who is cinema studies, autobiography, personal media. So I kind of sit kind of between the two. I'm kind of trying to work out how to balance that tightrope of being like cinema practice, but also like very much like data, computer science, theory, thinking about maybe getting another supervisor from someone in like science that can be like, this is actually what this algorithm's doing.
Yeah.
Like, because they're really hard to learn.
Yeah, and is anyone else sort of doing anything similar? You know, a PhD similar to what you're doing? Do you know? Or?
I mean, there's definitely like a big field that's opening up in what's called computational nonfiction, or in like digital poetics, and it kind of depends on which background you come from. So like on a writerly side, you have digital poetics, which is sort of Twitter poems and that sort of thing. And then on like the computer side, like in like the Silicon Valley side, you have people building like the bot that wrote like the new Harry Potter, like that was like doing the rounds.
Yeah.
So that's like all in this like computational fiction and like algorithm authors. And then who else? There's so many people doing lots of stuff. It's a really great conference in Melbourne like a few weeks ago called Digital Intimacy that kind of like combines all of this stuff. Because there's fields of like online identity as well, and like digital ethnography. Ooh,
wow.
Friday pronunciation.
Whoa, that's
digital ethnography, auto ethnography. So there's lots of people working kind of in lots of different parts of this field, because it's kind of bubbling. It intersects in so many different things, like be it like social science or like creative practice. And I think like sort of the artistic affordances of data is becoming like a bigger thing. There are lots of artists as well that are working with data. A lot of it comes from like Fitbit based art. So there's lots of like really beautiful like heartbeat based art that's been coming out at the moment. So work recently with it was like, if you reached out to touch this heart, it would start beating with the artist's heartbeat, like, and you could set the period of time when it was recorded from. And metronomes as well. There's a lot of work that a factory, a lab in Denmark have been doing with like putting people's heartbeats into metronomes and like letting you go through those, which is really, really, really fascinating. The UK, there's a lot of art as well. There's lots of different clusters. There's kind of like James Bridle, who wrote that big essay about YouTube that sort of shot off on Medium a few weeks ago and got everyone really, really worried about YouTube. Him and a bunch of other like new media scholars and artists in London do lots of stuff with this. And then there's kind of like Silicon Valley, New York kind of stuff. And then in the middle of Europe, there's lots of weird art stuff going on as well.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a really big emerging field. It's really exciting.
Question.
Stephanie, how far did your audience's interpretation or imagining of narrative differ from your memories of those moments, and can you give us some juicy examples?
Yeah, I guess, like, so, there was just so many things that people presented to me that I was like, what?
Nope.
It's like, I'm trying to think of, like, a specific one that's not, like, really embarrassing. I think it is almost like those ones, like people like being like, oh, I never knew you were interested in like health stuff, and it's like, no, not me. Like a friend of mine was like, oh, it's so sad, you seemed really stressed about like VCE. I was like, no, I was in like my third year of uni in that book. You have misinterpreted my age. Yeah, it was, and yeah, it's like I almost like don't even trust my memories of the data anymore as well. Like that red sky example, like looking at it, it's like, well, I obviously didn't finish my night listening to Courtney Barnett, because that would have actually been at the top. They're all in like reverse chronological order, but then that's split by like weeks or months in a really weird way. So some parts of it are, yeah, just backwards, and then other parts of it are scrambled backwards. But yeah, I feel like I've given myself like these pseudo memories through it, and it's like, am I actually remembering everything that I searched? That'd be impossible. No one has that much memory, right?
Mm.
No.
No.
Yeah, it's really weird. It's like, I feel like it's like in photographic theory, there's lots of stuff about like photos give you memories that don't actually exist. And I think the data's the same. Like it's planting these memories in my head, and I'm just interpreting them like everyone else is.
Probably the things that you remember that you searched about are four of the things that you don't want anyone to know about. The things that you would be like, if I got caught looking for this right now, would I A, lose my job, or B, really embarrassed? Those are the things you probably remember the most.
Yeah, true. I don't know, I feel like the ones that I remember the most out of it are like really mundane things, like being like, oh, I was really excited about looking at border collies that day. Like, I remember when I found this dog eating an ice cream. It was so good. And there's lots of, like, yeah.
Search history.
Yeah.
I'm interested in your relationship with the internet now. And, like, when you, after you've done this, you go to Google with trepidation, or you just get right back into the swing of it, or?
Oh, I've just given up. there's nothing we can do about it. Like, even if you don't use the internet, if someone you know uses the internet, you have a shadow profile built around you with what your potential friendship circles and like likes are. Like, Facebook has built a friendship algorithm to analyze people that appear in tagged photos that aren't there, and like look at like stuff that isn't there. And so I've gave up. It'll be fine, right? I think the only thing that I, like, it's hard because my PhD, I am letting them collect everything, and I'm trying not to restrict that. But the one thing I really do want to do is the tape over the camera, because I think probably, yeah, the facial recognition data, and how easy it is to do that and to wirelessly turn on someone else's camera is like the scariest thing. And it's like the one thing that I really want to do, and it's probably the thing I'm most conscious of. Like, I do note that I try and use my laptop in a way like this, where I'm like kind of like out of the range of it a little bit, just because like that's what bothers me the most. I think this stuff is kind of like, it's like, what are they gonna do with it? Like, sell me more shoes that I don't want? One of the main interested things I have is monster trucks, and I cannot work out why. It's like my top
like on Google, they're like, yep, your main thing that you like is monster trucks. And it just, it's so wrong most of the time.
That was me too.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really creepy.
It's so weird, yeah. Right? Like, where did this come from? Has someone paid to, like, make, like, the profile for everyone like monster trucks? Yeah, it's, it hasn't really changed how I use the internet at all. I think partly because I think it's a bit, like, the stuff that's collected isn't, like, that telling, and like I don't see a lot of stuff in it, but at the same time that, yeah, I've given up. I've started letting them collect everything for my PhD, and it's like, oh, now it's too late. They already know too much. Like, it'll be fine.
Any other questions? No? I have heaps, but you know, we probably won't be here all night if I keep on going. One thing I did want to ask though was about incognito, because you mentioned that before, and I'm sure we'll all use it at some point.
Yep.
So you can't get any data from an incognito search, or can Google still have that? Do they still have that data?
Apparently it's not kept. I do not believe that for a second. I think there's definitely an encrypted file of what everyone's looking at on incognito. Because if you look at like the advertising they use for it, right? It's like, don't let people know what presents you're buying them. And it's like, that's a really like legitimate use that I think they've found a lot of people use that for. And it's like, how are you like making these connections? I mean, if you look at even like Netflix's advertising at the moment, like where they're like going through being like, we found this one person that's like watched this film every day of the year. And it's like, that's very bad. But it also makes me feel like they are collecting everything, even when they say that they're not collecting it, because the idea of like something like Netflix is that no one should be able to be identified in like aggregate data like that. But Netflix and Spotify are doing that. They're finding like one person that's done this, and that one person is going to be like, oh, that's me. But yeah, I think there's definitely like a little vault, like a very secret place of everyone's like incognito browsers, and like we're not allowed to see it, but it'll be there because it's money. It'd make people a lot of money to know what's there, and I think surely police use it. I think especially like in the US, like there's lots of stuff that goes on with like ISPs that's very like you can look through everything. So the same technology that they use to, the idea for like a lot of ISPs, they do what's called like a deep packet inspection, and it's basically like you can see everything that's been transmitted through a computer. And the idea is that for internet service providers, like it's like, oh, we can use that to make sure no one's hacking the internet. But the reality is the government uses it to read every email that every person has sent and like go through that stuff and be like, oh, you sent an email saying like this, like you're arrested now. So yeah, the technology is not being used for the things that it says it is at the same time.
Do you think you've become a bit more, like, were you deeply suspicious of the internet before you started this project, and then, and or maybe you were less, you were much more?
I don't know. I think I thought it would be worse than it was. I think I probably am. Sometimes I sound like an internet, like, oh, it's coming to get you, but it is, it's going to get you. I think, yeah, I'm probably very conscious of that kind of stuff now, and a bit more, like, read a bit more into it, and, like, I do read all of the terms and conditions now, which is how I found out that, like, Clue sells on all of their data to this women's health study. Because there's so many really funny little clauses you find in there. Like, no one, like, we've all agreed that Facebook can use our, the facial recognition data, but you just don't think.
No.
Yeah.
Any last questions? No? Well, if you could all just join me thanking Stephanie again. That was Stephanie Milsom talking about data mining, digital privacy, and art. You can find out more about Stephanie's work on her website, www.stephaniemilsom.com. We hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we'd love you to review us on iTunes. It does help other people to find out about CardiCast and lets us know we're on the right track. Keep an ear out for more CardiCasts. Check out our website at newcardigan.org for more events. And remember, folks, JFDI.